Our Heavenly Father, we want to thank you for the wonderful way you work into our lives, that you touch us through other people, as well as directly by your Spirit and through your Word. We think of all the people who you've used to impact our lives over the years, and the wonderful way you have a sovereignty over our life to bring us into contact with those people we need, and then to make us in turn a blessing to others. Father, your word is truly a fragrance of life which spreads all around this world. And as we think of this, we think of the ministry of the Schaeffers and the way you used it to be a fragrance for life to so many, many people. And we praise you for that. And as we continue to think about the way you used their work, we pray, Father, that you will teach us to glorify you for the wonderful things you do among us. And that it may give us confidence as well to know that you can work in our lives and enable us to be a blessing to other people. And we ask this, Father, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Okay. Whoever has any questions, please fire ahead. Rob, why don't you start? That's a good question. I'll repeat the question. The question was, one can read Schaeffer's books, and there's all this material in them that he's brought together from many different sources. He's talking about different writers and painters and musicians and just all kinds of people. And these books show a great depth of understanding across many, many fields. And yet I have said in my last lecture, I've described the very busy life that he led. When did he have time to study? That's the essence of your question, isn't it? Yes. That's a very good question, because he certainly did live an extraordinarily busy life. He would read all the time that he wasn't doing other things. You know, he's a very hard-working man. That was one of the things I said he got from his father. You know, throughout his life, he was a very, very hard-working person. He had indeed studied very hard in college. He had a very good memory. I think he was probably the top graduating student of his seminary. And he won prizes at his college. You know, so when he was formally studying, he was studying hard. And he always read very widely. When he went to Europe on that first trip, that just sparked a sort of latent interest that was there but hadn't had a chance to flourish before. It sparked a latent interest in the arts. And he would then, you know, he had all kinds of fascinating books in his room. People were always sending him things, too. He would try to keep abreast with magazines and articles and so on that he got and that other people would send him. On many of his days off, on many of their holidays, they would go and visit museums and read and do things which he normally didn't have time to do, because he really enjoyed that. I mean, it was a great source of pleasure for him to go somewhere and to look at some museums or to read about some artist or musician or whatever. So he carried on, if you like, becoming a more and more cultured person, to use that word in its right sense, throughout his life. But it's an important question, because it raises an issue which we all have to come back to as we're looking at some of his books. One of the areas where he's been most strongly criticized by other Christians, not so much by non-Christians, but by other Christians, is that he wasn't academic enough. You will find that criticism in all of the critical essays or books that have been written about him. That there weren't enough footnotes in his books, that sometimes he would summarize a person's work in a way which didn't do them justice. There are particular examples which which have come up many, many times. Two of them are what he said about Kierkegaard, and the other is Thomas Aquinas. And in both of those, in terms of what he said about them, he's been very, very strongly criticized by other Christians. I think there are several responses one could make. He never claimed to be an academic. He wasn't writing an academic history of the development of Western culture, with all the necessary footnotes, etc. He was a popularizer, and he understood himself very clearly that way. I think the second thing one should say was that his gift was painting in broad strokes, rather than in dealing in minute detail with the development of a particular thinker or a particular period or whatever. Let me give you an illustration. When I first heard him lecture, he came to speak at Manchester University, where I was a student. I wasn't a Christian at the time. I was studying English literature. Well, I'm sure even as an undergraduate student of English literature, I had read more than he had in terms of English literature. I mean, that was my field. But his lecture, even though it didn't have a lot of detail, was like an illumination over the history of English literature, and was far more helpful than anything I'd heard from any of my lecturers at university. Though it didn't have the detail, because he was what my lecturers refused to deal with as typical modern secular men, was the meaning of literature. We spent all our time looking at structure and form and language, and nobody ever dealt with the ideas that the great writers have themselves struggled with, simply because those writers were raising questions that my teachers didn't have answers to themselves, and therefore they weren't prepared to look at those issues. I had found in my 3 years at university in England studying English literature myself increasingly frustrated by the fact that we spend all our time thinking about the details and never dealing with the real issues of literature. So that by the end of our 3 years, in one way, we were no closer to understanding what literature was really about than we were when we started. And that's where Schaefer's lecture, and he certainly wasn't a specialist in English literature, that wasn't one of his fields. I mean, you could say he knew far more about philosophy and about the arts, about painting, than he did about English literature. But what he said was just so helpful, because he painted in very broad brushstrokes and gave a kind of summary of what had happened in English literature over a 500-year period, which was accurate as a broad summary. You could find individual exceptions to it, but he would have acknowledged that. But he really did describe the direction in which English literature had flowed over that period of 500 years, in terms of its approach to reality and where it's come to today. So that's my second point. He was painting in broad brushstrokes. The third is this, that some of the areas where he's been particularly criticized, like on Kierkegaard and Thomas Aquinas, you will find many scholars who study those men in great detail who would actually agree with his definition. In terms of Kierkegaard, he is a person where there is a huge amount of disagreement over exactly where he stood. You see, what Schaefer said about Kierkegaard, for example, was that Kierkegaard was the father of both secular and theological existentialism. And then he made some careful qualifications about Kierkegaard himself, and that he wouldn't probably approve at all of some of the things that were done with his approach. Now, many Christians have taken exception to that and said, no, Kierkegaard was really a faithful, believing Christian, and he was simply reacting against dead orthodoxy, and so on, because Kierkegaard is such an outstanding figure as a human being that I think many evangelical Christians want to be able to say, yes, he is one of us, because he has so many wonderful insights. Now, if, however, you go and look at secular existentialists, they will tell you that they see Kierkegaard as the father of their thinking. I mean, Schaefer's insight is not inaccurate. He is quite correct. And the same if you go to theological existentialists, they will see Kierkegaard as their father. There is no question about it. Now, Schaeffer wasn't making a judgment about whether he was individually a Christian or not. That's another issue. But the same is true with Thomas Aquinas. You could find many scholars who would agree with Schaeffer's analysis of Thomas Aquinas. There are others who would disagree, but these points where he's usually strongly criticized are areas which are actually areas of academic disagreement anyway, rather than simply that he has made some gross error here. It's easier to dismiss what he says as an error because he does paint with such broad strokes. Having said that, though, I think that in the great majority of what he says, he can't actually be faulted. But it is true he wasn't an academician. He didn't do a great deal of really detailed work, but I don't think there's any doubt that that most of what he said is an accurate representation of what other people thought, and certainly of the effects of their thinking on those around them, on the generations that came later. But he did study a lot. You know, you say, when did he have time? He took the time whenever he had it. People used to ask me the same question, working in Libri, when do you study? How do you find time to prepare these lectures? And so on. And I would say, well, to be quite frank, I study when I go to the bathroom. I study when I'm in the bath. You know, I study on holiday. Wherever I go on a train anywhere or catch a plane anywhere, I take books to read. You do it whenever you can. Because in that kind of life, you don't have a formal time. You can sit down every day and say, I am going to spend 4 hours studying today. And he never had that. He never had that. His study was squeezed in everywhere he could squeeze it. But I think God gave him a gift of being able to see very clearly and very quickly the heart of an issue, and to go past the details. Now, that led him sometimes to make mistakes. But he most clearly had a gift of being able to see what was the heart of an issue that came before him. And that's why many people have spoken of him as a prophet, in the sense that he said things about what was happening in our society long before most evangelical Christians were even aware of what was happening. You know, somebody would send him an article in Time magazine, and he would see the value of it, and he would use that as the basis for a lecture on something. And you're aware, many people would read it and say, oh, that's interesting, and not give it another thought. He would say, well, that's where our culture's going. That's where we're going. And there's a very interesting little thing I showed everybody in the course on his early years. It was something he wrote back in 1945 or 46. It was the first Kinsey report on sexuality in America. And he wrote a little pamphlet at that time called Sin is Normal. Just looking at the way the Kinsey Report was basically saying, you know, what the American people do is what is right. There is no sin. What is natural is right. There are many Christians who still don't think about that issue today, you know, and he saw that very clearly right then in 1945. And that really was, I think, a gift that God gave him, the ability to really discern what was the fundamental issue at stake in a writer, in a painting, in music, whatever. I think the other thing one should add, though, is this, that when you find him making generalized statements about somebody, it is important to remember that he's not thereby dismissing the person or saying that was all they said. He is trying to say something which can accurately be said, but it doesn't tell you everything you can say. You know, and he would have acknowledged that himself very, very clearly. In fact, you sometimes find little notes to that effect in his books as you go. Okay. That's a good question. In fact, it helps me to answer the first question more as well, and that was, in Libri now, most of the branches of Libri now close for several weeks each year, and that gives the workers time to study and to work on lectures and so on. And Larry's question is, how did those of us in Libri choose what subject we would study during a study period we had? Yeah, that helps me to say something extra about Schaeffer as well. In the early years of Libri, there were patches where there was nobody there. Those became increasingly less frequent. But in the first few years of Libri, they had people every weekend, but there were often patches during the week when there were very few people and sometimes nobody. except one or two people who were staying with him as helpers. And during that period, he had far more time to study. If you take, for example, one set of tapes we've got in there, which were never put in book form, were tapes he did on the Second Vatican Council. And he traveled down to Italy several times to actually attend some of those sessions and read a great deal about it at the time, and then came back and gave a series of lectures on the Second Vatican Council, where he did a great deal of thinking and study about modern Roman Catholicism at that time and where it was going, what Vatican II was really about. So during those early years, he had far more time to study than he did later. And I think much of the foundation for many of the things he said later was laid during the 50s, and early 60s, before Labrie became just packed out all the time. You know, in relationship to Larry's question, once when we started the English Labrie in 1971, we had no time when nobody was there. We always had people, all the time, all the year round. I mean, you were always, there was, Labrie operates by a tyranny of the immediate. You know, the most important thing is the people who are staying with you and their needs, and that's what you try and meet. It means study gets squeezed out. Now, for Schaefer, in the first years of Labrie, he had long patches of time when there weren't people around all the time. When most of the people of my generation, the second generation of people working in Labrie, got there, there was never a time when there weren't people there. And it was about, I suppose, 1984, we decided we would have to start closing. If we hadn't, we'd have all died, I think, apart from anything else. It wasn't just a question of needing time to study. It was also a question of just needing time. Time just to be a human being. And time with your family, and time with yourself, time with your children, time with your wife, and just time to do the ordinary things that you need to do just to function as a human person. I think we would have all had nervous breakdowns if we hadn't started closing. It seemed a very radical idea at first, but basically we were open all the year round except for a week at Christmas, and our holiday times were the worst times of the year, because we'd go away for 3 weeks holiday. And we'd come back and all our colleagues would be on holiday, so the effects of your holiday were demolished in 2 days, because you were doing three times as much as usual because everyone else was on holiday, and because it was the summer there was more people there than usual. So you just would die very quickly as soon as you got back. But the suggestion, which actually came from Richard Winter, who works at the English Labrie originally, came from Richard, that we should start closing, at first seemed such a radical suggestion, and there were people who said, oh, we're being completely unfaithful to the history of Labrie and this kind of thing. But it saved everybody's life, basically. And it also did give people a chance to study. And I think certainly in some of the branches, the quality of lectures has risen dramatically since that time. Now, in terms of what people study during those periods and how they choose, sometimes it's a matter of areas which an individual is particularly interested in. More often, though, it's a response to the kinds of questions that people are asking. Almost all the lectures I gave throughout my years in Labrie, I think every single one of them was in response to somebody's question. I would often sit at the table on Monday morning at breakfast and say, what would you like to have a lecture on? And not with any guarantee that they could have one the next day on that subject, but that at some time I would do something on it. And that's very stretching, because people would ask you kinds of things you'd never thought about. And you'd say, okay, well, I'll try and do something on that. So you're constantly having to stretch your own thinking and your own reading. But it's a very good discipline, and I'd recommend every pastor and teacher in the church to do it and say, actually, what do you want to hear? What do you need to hear? Not what do I feel like saying, but what do you need to hear? And let's study that. And that's certainly how I did my own study always, was finding out where people had their questions, where people were struggling, where they had their doubts, and where they felt they needed a lecture, and then I would go and work on it, do something in that area, both immediately and in terms of the long term of projects. I thought, well, this is an area where I need to do some more thinking on, this is an area where I do need to do some reading, would be always in response to somebody's questions. That's a good question. Was Schaefer criticized by people in the establishment, in the established church, for being too involved in the culture? maybe by a few, but he spoke so clearly about having some careful guidelines. I remember him saying, actually, it's interesting you raised the example of the Beatles. I was in Switzerland in 1967. I think that was the year that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band came out, that album of the Beatles, a wonderful album. And we all went down and listened to it one evening with Schaefer, and then we had a discussion about it. And he said very carefully afterwards, when you listen to something like this, you need to take a bath afterwards. And then he explained what he meant. And people would often ask him, you know, you write and speak about Bergman's films. But I use Bergman as an example. If you think of his film The Silence, I remember going to see that as a non-Christian, and it almost made me commit suicide on the spot. It was just so devastating. But you go see a film like that, and Schaefer's response would have been, if you go to see something like that, you need to have a spiritual bath afterwards. What he meant by that was, among other things, you need to pray about its effect on you. You also need to sit down with somebody and talk about it. What is being said in this? How is it being said? How effective is it? Is my thinking like that already? Because this is part of the culture in which I live. And what is the truth that stands over against this? And he recommended that's what one always did. Let me use the illustration of John Stott, because he's doing the same kind of thing all the time. He has this group of friends that he meets with every month or two in London, and they choose a film, a book, a piece of music or whatever, and they go and they read it together, or they go and watch the film together, or they go to the play together. It's always something very contemporary, which lots and lots of people in the culture are seeing or reading, and then they go and have an evening to discuss it. Well, that's really what Schaefer was saying. Not that you need to do that in some formal sense, though I would recommend it for those of you who are students here who are single, to get together with a group of other students and go and watch a film together, and then come home and discuss it afterwards, or a play. Or for those of you who are married, to go with your wife and a couple of other friends and see something, but discuss it afterwards. Don't just see it as entertainment. You see, that is where Christians really make a mistake. If I go see a Woody Allen film, it is entertaining. I mean, he's my favorite filmmaker. But I don't go and see it just as entertainment. I know I need to think about it afterwards, because he's a very profound creator. And he's wrestling with very profound ideas. And if we don't think about them, they will affect us. You know, communication doesn't have to go in directly through your mind and being rational about it to affect you. Sitting in front of the television all day, or sitting in front of movies all day, or listening to music all day will change the way you think, especially if you don't think about it. It will change it far more if you don't think about it, because it will shape you unconsciously with your being completely unaware. And that's what Schaefer meant by having a bath.
He emphasized that thinking to the people that were at the bridge?
Yes, he did, over and over and over again, because obviously, especially with young people, it's very easy to overreact. Suppose you're coming from, and many young people did, who came from Christian backgrounds, coming from situations where the culture was a complete no-no. No, it's completely ungodly to go to movies. You should never listen to rock music. It's all of the devil, etc. Obviously, there were many young people like that. He was very careful to try to be responsible and say, don't just kick over your parents' rules and your church's rules. You have got to be responsible yourself. Yes, Christ has set us free for freedom, and he would quote Paul in Galatians, but don't use your freedom either just to react against other people and hurt them. That's not loving, and he constantly kept emphasizing that about speaking the truth in love. And for your own self, realize that it's dangerous just to go and throw yourself into something just as a matter of reaction. You need to be really aware of your own spiritual health and of the powerful effectiveness of these things. So he would speak about it all the time, yes, as something that people ought to be careful of. Now, I'm sure some young people left the Brie and went overboard. And there were a few people who criticized him very strongly for thinking, understanding the culture was important. Even Martin Lloyd-Jones, for example, who he knew personally, thought that his emphasis on culture was a complete distraction from evangelism. And he said so publicly. But I think so many, many people in America who could have been people who might have been critical were so thankful for the fact that there were so many of their own children and young people from their own churches who were really helped by going to Switzerland and were helped by Schaefer, that they didn't criticize him. There were many people who felt their own children were drifting away from the faith. I mean, I'm talking about seminary professors and Christian college teachers and pastors who felt they were losing their own children, who went to Le Brie and they got really helped and they came back, and those people weren't prepared to criticize them. Of course they weren't. Yeah, because they were just so thankful that somebody had helped their kids when they felt they were losing them. And so I think most people saw very clearly that he had a really balanced and carefully thought out position here. And he would say that very often he hadn't even seen some of these movies that he talked about, that he had read reviews of them. And he was quite honest about that. He certainly went to see some of them, but he didn't see every movie that he spoke about. But that's an excellent question. I mean, it's a very important issue. But it is quite interesting in a way, because coming out of the separatist background that he came from, these things really were an absolute no. But as I said, you know, his own background was non-Christian. He never bought into that personal legalism. Edith had a real problem with it as a young Christian herself. She loved to dance, which was a complete no-no. So she never bought into that, and they just learned quite quickly to have a very sensible attitude towards these things. Rebecca. Yeah, where does one draw the line in terms of finding out about the culture, and where did Schaefer draw the line? I think he would have made several responses to that question. And I'll try to think in his shoes for a moment. But I think the first thing he would have said is, you have to be aware of what is happening to you in terms of your own state as an individual, that your own thinking as a person, and that will vary depending on your maturity as a Christian and many other things. Let me use an illustration from my own life. Before I was a Christian, I had two favorite kinds of music that I listened to a great deal. One was rhythm and blues, a lot of which is very sad, and a lot of which speaks very painfully and acutely about the brokenness of the human condition. And I listened to it because I identified with it completely. I mean, that's where I was. It described where I was as a person. The other kind of music I listened a lot to was classical music from composers like Richard Strauss and Mahler. And again, I listened to it for some of the same reasons. And Debussy. Because, again, it laments the human condition in a very acute way. If you've ever heard, for example, the music from Strauss's opera Electra, it's from that famous Greek story. And the opera is partly about the futility of life in this world and about the way people are driven to desperation by feeling trapped in their existence. In the end of that opera, if you remember the Greek story, Orestes has to kill his mother. He's required to do so because she has committed adultery and had her husband murdered, his father. By his culture, he's required to put his mother to death as an act of justice, Clytemnestra. But then the Fury, it's also a sin to kill your mother. I mean, he's caught in his culture. He's caught by the gods. and he is driven to madness then by the Furies. And there's no escape for him. And all Greek drama is like that. People are absolutely trapped in this web of fate from which they cannot escape. They have their duty, which they have to carry out, and they'll be punished if they don't, and if they do, they'll be punished anyway. And there's no escape. Well, for where I was, as a non-Christian who was basically in a very existentialist position, that music summarized exactly where I was as a person. And I listened to it because it confirmed my understanding of reality. You might say, well, that's rather morbid, making yourself feel even more miserable. Yes, it most certainly is. And I think for anybody in that position, there is an element of an ugly kind of self-centeredness and self-pity, which is bound up into digging yourself ever deeper into the mire in which you find yourself. But I didn't know anything else to make an excuse for myself. Now, when I became a Christian, I wasn't able to listen to either of those kinds of music for several years without them immediately having the same kind of impact on me that they'd had before. Because music is very powerful, and it evokes all kinds of feelings in you over which you have very little control, particularly when you've given yourself to that music, as I had done. As a young Christian, I had to stop listening to it because it was very destructive to me personally, in terms of just sinking me into a state of despair and self-pity. Now, within 5 years, I could listen to it with no problem at all, and it didn't have the same effect. I was able to be a little more objective about it. Now, I just use that as an illustration to make the point that it is very important that we understand how things are affecting us. That we don't think my Christian freedom means that I can go to any movie, I can listen to any music, no matter what it does to me. We really need to be aware. I remember another young man who came to stay with us who was coming from a kind of existentialist position, and he loved to read Camus and Kafka. Well, again, when he was converted, he had to stop reading it for a couple of years because it had shaped his whole understanding of reality. And he admired those writers so much that to start reading them again for a while had the same effect. You just have to be sensible. The other thing I would say for all of us, whether we've got any particular background like that or not, we all need to be aware of our own sinfulness. I've seen movies, for example, which I wish I had never been to see. Movies are a very powerful medium. They create images which are there on the screen and they stay in your mind. And they make your mind dirty. They can do. And some of them we can do without. Let me give you an illustration. I went to see James Joyce's Ulysses. I wish I had never seen it. I cannot forget it. No, I wish I hadn't seen it because of some of the images that were in that movie. I don't need that. All of us are sinful enough anyway without having things paraded on a screen in a dramatic way which you will never forget. You know, there are certain films I simply would not go to see. I have no desire to see them because I'm aware of my own weaknesses. And I think it's very important that we acknowledge that. I think Schaeffer would have said that very strongly. He did say that very strongly. That freedom must never become a basis for the indulgence of one's sinful nature. So those are the first two things in relationship to ourself. I think the second thing he would have said is that we have to be very careful not to put a stumbling block in the way of other people. Now, he tried to be careful how he expressed this, though, because the Pharisees in the church used that argument to impose their views on everybody else. The legalists say, we don't think you should do this, so nobody should do it, and you're causing me to be offended if you do it. They're turning Paul's argument about not causing an offense on its head when they do that. What he's talking about is people who know they have freedom, like he did himself, as a believer, mature Christians who know they have freedom, not being a stumbling block to other younger, struggling believers who really would offend their own conscience if they joined in with this behavior. Not to the Pharisee, who's just making rules for everybody, and who's not going to stumble at all, who's just going to, in fact, use it as a means to judge somebody if they do something. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't be concerned about the legalist. we ought to love everyone, including the legalist. But sometimes we need to challenge them with their legalism rather than allow them to dictate to the whole church about how everybody else should live. Paul's argument about being an offence is addressed to making sure we don't cause other people to stumble who are not clear in their own conscience about what is right. Let's use an illustration. Suppose I think that it's perfectly all right for a Christian to dance or to drink or to go to a movie or whatever it happens to be. And I do those things in moderation. But I have some young Christian coming to stay with us who has been brought up in a home and in a church where they have been told that all of those things, ever drinking alcohol, ever going to a movie, ever dancing, are really sinful. I may discuss the subject with the person who comes to stay with me, but the last thing I will do is serve him wine at the table, or take him to a movie, or take him to a dance. Because when somebody's first coming to deal with an issue like this, their own conscience isn't clear. And Paul says, if you sin against your own conscience, even if your conscience is wrong, that's a sin. You mustn't offend your own conscience, even if it's misinformed. So you need to be very careful always for the younger Christian that you're not doing things which are going to really put trouble in somebody else's life and cause them to offend their own conscience. The third is, it's very important to not go out of our way to offend people. And there it becomes a matter of principle, or rather it becomes a matter of prudence, to know when to stand on a principle and when to give up whatever it is one does or knows one has the freedom to do for the sake of others. And you can think of Paul here, and Schaefer used this example many times. There's one occasion, you remember, where Paul is, it has Timothy, or is it Titus, circumcised, because the Judaizers will be offended if he isn't. Who is it, Timothy or Titus? Timothy, thank you. He has Timothy circumcised. Now, does Paul do that because he thinks everybody should be circumcised? No. He says neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is anything, just a new creation. But he does it because he doesn't want to upset anybody. So he's prepared to do all kinds of things which are not necessary for the sake of the gospel. He'll be a Jew to the Jew and a Greek to the Greeks for the sake of the gospel, even if it means doing all kinds of things that he wouldn't normally do himself, which he has the freedom not to do. But if it's made a principle by these other people, and they say everybody has got to be circumcised, or nobody must ever go to a movie, or nobody must ever drink a glass of wine because that's really wicked, or whatever the issue happens to be, then is the time to stand up, like Paul said, and say, hold on a minute, you're preaching another gospel. You're preaching another gospel. There is only one way of salvation, and that is through Jesus Christ. There is only one measure of spirituality, and that is a person's relationship with the Lord. Not whether they do this particular thing or not, whether it's having somebody circumcised, or going to a movie or not going to a movie, or obeying some rules that somebody set up about this or that or anything else. One has to stand on the matter of principle at some point. You know, when it becomes an issue which threatens to cloud the nature and freedom of the gospel. And that's where we have to pray for the wisdom of the Holy Spirit to know when to stand and when to just quietly go along and do whatever one's going to do. Like Paul says, I won't eat meat till the world ends. It's going to upset somebody, even though I have perfect freedom to eat meat. But if they make it a principle and say anybody who eats meat cannot be a true believer, then you say, hold on a minute, that's not the gospel at all. That would be the second whole area of what you could call offense, and being wise and prudent there, and really praying for God's wisdom about one's freedom as a Christian to be involved in the culture. The third area, I think, is equally important, and that is, it was precisely because he was prepared to be involved in the culture that Schaefer was able to communicate to so many non-Christians. And there is a biblical command there, which we're going to be talking about a lot in apologetics, that if we are really going to communicate to people, we have to understand the culture in which they live. And there's no way to understand it if I say, I will never read anything written by a non-Christian. I will never listen to any music produced by a non-Christian. I will never go to a movie unless it's made by a Christian. That is one of the very serious problems of the church today, that it has built a wall around itself of involvement in only Christian things to keep ourselves safe from the world, to keep ourselves safe from this wicked culture around us. And it's no wonder that evangelism is so difficult. Well, somebody has got to break that wall down and start actually trying to understand the culture to communicate with people, and that's what Schaefer did. And it's very important to be able to do that, but with these other provisos in mind all the time. But if somebody comes to you and says, well, I don't care how many non-Christians you reach out to, no Christian should ever have anything to do with this culture at all, you have to say, hold on a minute here, there's something really basic at stake, which is the fulfillment of the Great Commission, which I'm afraid is far more important than your rules. And in the end, it demonstrates a very serious insecurity about the gospel if we don't think that it has the power to confront the culture and to deal with it. I mean, this is the truth. We don't need to be bothered about what other people are saying. We should have every confidence. In fact, I would say exactly that. The more you begin to understand the culture in which we live, the more we read and see and be involved in what our culture is producing, the more we will become acutely aware of the powerful truth of the gospel and its liberating nature, and how little our culture has to offer people. I think that exposure to the culture strengthens Christians rather than weakens them. But we see what the alternatives are. And I would add finally, and really in relationship to this, it's a matter of compassion to the unbeliever. It's simply that. I am very thankful that there were some Christians like Schaefer and Mike Timshack, the person I was converted through, who had spent time at Labrie and who played Schaefer's tapes. I am very thankful that God raised up people like that who were prepared to understand the culture, because I wouldn't be a Christian today if there wasn't somebody who had done that. And there are a lot of other people in the same position. Okay, I know there's a couple more of you who had questions here. Rob, I know you had a question you haven't had a chance to ask. Okay.